After another tough loss for the Mets, we're going to get into it with Jerry Blevins, Edwin Diaz, and Luis Rojas. His decision-making on Wednesday night, we'll get into all of it. It starts right now. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Shane Anything Podcast. It's Doug Williams and Jerry Blevins with you on today's episode. A reminder to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. We appreciate it. And Shane Anything is brought to you by Verizon. It's 5G built right for the Mets from the network. More people rely on only on Verizon. And once again, 6 o'clock weeknights on SNY. Well, 5:30 this week with the 6:40 starts down in Miami. Check out Baseball Night in New York. Good baseball conversation every night on SNY on your good old-fashioned television, 6 o'clock. Jerry is joining us today from his car where he is playing golf. It's kind of weird because I've got the fancy hair today. You've got the hat on. Usually your locks are flowing and I've got the hat on. I'm super casual. So roles reversed.
I'm a little out of sorts here. I'm doing a charity golf outing for a really close and dear friend of mine. And I'm not in my studio, and so I'm a little out of sorts. So it's good though. I feel uncomfortable. It's nice to be. It's a little live TV, like being on BNNY. So I'm excited.
Get outside that comfort zone a bit.
That's right.
So Jerry, Mets fans are just trying to cling to some sort of hope, and the hope for a long time has been Nationals Marlins, Nationals Marlins, and every time the Mets lose a game to one of those teams, it feels like the season's over. And statistically, it's not. And I know that winning games on the road is difficult. It doesn't matter who you're playing. These are big league quality teams. Before we get into the specifics, because there is a lot to get to, in a clubhouse, do you think that feeling kind of pops up where you have a big loss and suddenly you're like, shoot, do we have a chance at this thing anymore?
Not now, not yet. So as a fan, you know, I'm experiencing newly over here on this side of things, and it feels so much more dramatic every up and down. It's one of those things where it's hard not to be so encapsulated. Like the series in Washington, we could have and should have won at least 4, maybe all 5 of those games, right?
Yep.
But if you look at it from a big picture, you want to win series. You want to win series, and we won 3 out of 5. And so as a player, you just got to look at the whole picture all the time. Just focus on what you have today. They lost yesterday. It was a tough loss. Sandy Alcantara had it pitched a hell of a game. They, you know, they only gave him 1 run. Conforto got him for that big home run, some clutch hitting, but it was their ace, and he pitched really well, and we lost. And it can't be anything more than just one more loss. Mm. It's really dramatic for us because every loss to a subpar team when we're supposed to gain games feels heavier. But as a player in that clubhouse, you just got to move on and try to win a series. So they got to take these next two and move on from there. So it's more of a day-to-day, whereas for us, we feel it moment to moment.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is you're right to bring up Alcantara. Because he was dominant and he's a really, really, really good pitcher. You know, he's the hardest throwing starting pitcher in baseball. However, the game and the storyline around the game took so many sharp turns and, you know, it ended so suddenly that's really not the storyline. Like Mets fans aren't sitting at home right now being like, yeah, we got beat by, you know, a great starting pitcher, which in reality is the truth. The storyline instead is, you know, Edwin Diaz comes in. I know it's not his earned run, but he allows that inherited runner to score. And look, it feels like we've heard this story before. So let's talk about Diaz before we get into the Rojas decision, because there's a lot to unpack there. You've watched him pitch up close, I'm guessing, you know, in bullpen sessions, what have you. How does somebody with such nasty stuff consistently get hit the way he does?
Well, for me, it's location. It's falling behind to hitters. It's leaving balls over the heart of the plate. For me, his stuff is so good when he's on that he could throw it pretty much anywhere in any count. But when he's like in Washington, when he struggled, he walked some guys. He fell behind. Guys start to feel a little bit more comfortable in the box, knowing that they don't have to chase that strike to ball slider or the fastball that looks like it's coming and then it's going to tail in on their hands, they feel more comfortable because they can wait them out knowing that they're either going to get into an advantage count situation or they're going to get something over the heart of the plate. And so for me, it's just, it's location, being able to locate your pitch, not necessarily pinpoint, because his stuff is so good that he doesn't need to locate like I did. He needs to be able to hit the side, stay out of the middle. And he hasn't been able to do that, unfortunately. And teams have taken advantage of it. So it's as simple as being able to get into your advantage counts and take advantage of those counts where you're ahead and being able to get guys to chase.
So the thing, Jerry, is that it feels like we've had this conversation before. I don't know if you and I have specifically, but I know every Met fan listening has listened to us on this podcast talk about Edwin Diaz and his great stuff. And, you know, maybe it's mental, maybe it's mechanical. Jeremy Hefner's here. He wants to fix him, stay on top of the ball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The problem that I think I've arrived at, and I think Mets fans arrived at long ago, is that maybe, as we talked about earlier this week, maybe this is a change of scenery guy who didn't need one. He was thriving in Seattle. He had, you know, the best season of his career, an incredible season as a closer. He gets dealt here. And I think there's now at this point, something to be said about the fact that he just has not been that guy in a New York Met uniform. So as much as I hear you with the location and I want to dig into why this is happening, the, you know, talk radio host side of me is like, it's just never going to work here. And, you know, he can figure out his mechanics all he wants, but is it ever going to work here?
Well, for me, like a change of scenery is tough because you see what guys like Steven Matz do when they're uncomfortable or get into a little bit of a rut and go to a new place and start to excel. For a guy like Diaz, though, I felt like when he started this year and he looked so good in spring training and he was so dominant that it was just a blip on the radar of a struggle. Like he seemed to be back to his old self. And it was like a minor mechanical fix. I remember talking to him and Hef about it in spring training. And so maybe it's just another tweak. I don't think it's as drastic as he might not work here, but you know, I think he's an elite closer, but he's just been inconsistent. And speaking for just solely for myself, the best thing that I ever did, like there was two things that I brought to the table, was availability and being ready to pitch every day and reliability. And so you knew what you were going to get from me. It wasn't Edwin Diaz at his best, not even close. I'm not that good of a pitcher, but you knew baseline what you were going to get. And I think that's where it hurts the most, is he's been so dominant for stretches and then just completely loses it. And so that's the hard part. I don't know if it's a change of scenery. I think it might just be one more tweak again, but you have to be able to make those as a professional in game on the fly, because as a, like, you know, in the bullpen, it's pass fail and there's too many fails. And when the season's on the line, it feels like every night, everything gets magnified. And so I don't know if it's a change of scenery. He might not work in New York. I wouldn't go that far. I just think he just needs to be more consistent and find out what he needs to do to be more consistent.
Pass fail is a really good way to put it and a really good way to describe your job. And I think, look, Edwin Diaz is not that far removed from success even this season. Like I hate to keep bringing it up because I know this is a Mets podcast, but you know, Aroldis Chapman with the Yankees again last night, he looks lost. Like he's never succeeded before. Like he forgets the level of pitcher that he is. Diaz is closer, but it's just, it's equally frustrating for Mets fans because again, we keep having these conversations about, you know, how do you fix him? The slider command wasn't there. Why is he throwing all fastballs? Those conversations that get into the nitty gritty, whereas most people at this point have arrived at the conclusion that it just ain't going to work. And maybe he'll be a closer somewhere else again, but we've arrived at the point again where one run lead, big game, September now, Mets fans are going to be on the edge of their seat, if not standing, because they're so nervous watching that happen. So look, I just think that that's the elephant in the room here, that as interesting as it is to listen to conversations that you and I have about, you know, whether he can figure it out or what Hef says about him mechanically, it's just, are we past the point of no return?
Yeah, you just want consistency, and I think he wants it from himself. I wouldn't be overstepping my bounds thinking that that's what he wants to do. He wants to be successful. He works hard. I just think he needs to find whatever that mechanical tweak is and be able to do it in game. And so that's the only thing is you can't walk guys like you did in Washington, and you just want to be consistent.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into Louie, because it obviously relates to Edwin Diaz. Since like a month ago on the podcast, when I said, any Met fan out there who wants Louie Rojas gone, point to some in-game decisions he's made and, you know, find me something and then I'll take it more seriously. Basically, since I said that, he has made some very iffy decisions as the manager. And, you know, last night when they decided to pitch to De La Cruz, it looked like Rojas was really focused on the infield and, you know, they're shifting, and he post game really made it seem like he never really considered walking De La Cruz. So, you know, we'll get to the De La Cruz decision in a second, but first, you know, he pinch hits James McCann, who's making a lot of money to be the starting catcher of the Mets and has struggled, like granted, for Mazzica. Well, opposite, he puts Mazzica in as the pinch hitter for James McCann. What did you think of that decision?
I think there might be more to it than what meets the eye. You know, McCann might have been early off the DL or off the IL because, you know, Cisco got hurt in Washington and they needed him to step up. I think it could be that. But Mazzica has also been stinging the ball. Maybe it was the left-handed bat. I'm not sure what it is. I just don't know what we're not seeing. There's so many things that go on behind the scenes, whether it's in the training room or whatnot. I would have liked to see McCann take that at bat and swing for himself there, because that's what he's getting paid to do. But I don't know. I can't question something where I don't know all the details.
So, you know, what's interesting, Jerry, and listening to you, you've talked and you've tweeted about how dramatic it is to be a fan. So your new perspective is, like, every game, you feel like everything's on the line. So it's interesting to hear you say, when I ask you that question, well, I don't know enough, because that is the former player in you being like, there's always more to these decisions than the fan at home knows. So how are you balancing that? I'm just curious, watching a game like last night, you're probably not quick to kill Louie Rojas, because I know that you respect him as a manager, but also, you're not in the room where it happened, to use a Hamilton reference. So you,
I was just going to say that hit my head, the Hamilton.
Yeah. So you're not quick to judge. So where's that balance, do you think, for the rest of us to try and learn from?
I don't know. I'm learning myself what it means to truly be a fan again. And I think there's always interesting points. If you heard what Derek Jeter said in his Hall of Fame speech, he brought up, you know, a bunch of names, very classy speech. But he mentioned the training staff, and he's like, sorry, I lied to you for all those years, because if I had a job to do and it was to be out there. It's a strange time in today's game where you want to be 100%. And there's a lot of people that will not tell you what's going on and then go out and struggle. Or tell you, and then they don't tell the media or don't tell the fans. And so there's so many things, so many moving parts. And so I know how hard it is to be a player, all the circumstances that are surrounding it, not on top of health. So I'll never second guess a player. I think it's fair to question, you know, Louie Rojas for the pinch hit. And if you ask him and he tells you the truth, then that's what it is. Also for pitching to De La Cruz, I think that's the bigger issue for me. I think that was a mistake, because you have a base open, you have a guy that's red hot. There's no reason to attack him there. And so that's the issue I have, but I'm learning how to be a fan too. I'm learning where to push buttons. I'll always be pro player. And because I know how difficult it is, how much is on the line, how heavy it is, how much it means to the players. It really does mean that much. I'll question some people's heart when it deserves it, when it's a lack of hustle, but if you're trying hard and you're giving a full effort, I'm going to have your back for the most part.
Moving on to the De La Cruz thing, I often question my own, focus or intensity level when we get to an at-bat like that and Gary and Ron in the booth are like, why pitch to him? Walk him. And as much as I'd like to say that that idea came to me organically, I learned through them that it was the right decision. I'm just being totally honest. I'm not a manager.
That's fair.
I'm watching on my couch, and De La Cruz looks like a nice player. He's made some really nice plays in the field, and he's clearly their best hitter right now, especially with Jesus Aguilar out. But I'm not thinking, Bryce Harper's up there, Mike Trout. It was the right decision not to pitch to him, it turned out. But it's because Gary and Ron are so smart and they're watching the game so closely that it became obvious. Like I don't want to frame it like it was always the obvious decision, because I'm not smart enough to watch the game like that. However, once somebody brings it up, you realize, okay, it was obviously the right decision. Walk him. He ends the game one swing of the bat. And it was the first thing that, Gary Cohen said in his call, like maybe the most controversial decision that Rojas has ever made. And then fast forward to Rojas in his post game, he's like, we like the righty righty matchup. So Jerry, help me out here. We're in the world of analytics, of numbers, of people that are supposed to be smarter than we are. And yet a decision of that high level of importance comes down to the batter having the same handedness as the pitcher. Like, is it 25 years ago suddenly? Like, which is it?
So first of all, listening to Gary and Ron is what you need to do, because these guys are so smart. Like the insight that Ron has, I'm in awe of. I really think he's an excellent baseball mind. And so that's a great place to get your information, first of all. And I think it's fair, because I completely agree. You don't need to pitch to De La Cruz. There were times in the Washington series that we pitched to Juan Soto. The home run that he hit off Diaz, not an issue for me because of the ball, where it was, where he hit it. The situation, you're up two runs, he's leading off. You got to throw strikes. You don't want to bring the tying run to the plate. But he hit a home run. There's just certain situations where you don't need to attack a guy. And for me, what I learned in my career as being a guy that's just, pretty average as far as a major leaguer with stuff wise. And I learned how to be better. I learned when to let guys go, when to walk a person, when to put myself in a better situation to be successful. And for me, pitching to De La Cruz was a big mistake. It was a mistake. I think, again, the righty righty matchup, it might be something that the Diaz feels more comfortable on the mound throwing his pitches right now in righty righty. So if you walk him to bring up a lefty, maybe he doesn't have a clue where the ball's going to go, because the guy batting on the left side of the batter's box, left side of the plate, just makes him look foreign. I don't know the mitigating circumstances, but I know Louis's going to stand up there and just say whatever he needs to say, whatever the thought process was. But I said it as soon as he stepped up to the plate. I was like, we don't need to pitch to him. We have a base open. Let's move along. And I think that was a mistake, and that's a fair criticism. In hindsight, even if he gets out there, it was a mistake. I think we attacked Juan Soto in a few times and got him out. And just because he got him out doesn't mean it was the right decision. I still think it was a mistake. So I think we're not taking advantage of these thinner lineups. We're pitching to hot guys when we don't need to. We're allowing mistakes to happen. And I think Louis will look at himself and say that was a mistake. I think he'll own up to it looking back on it. And I think it'd be fair. It was a mistake. I think he'll learn from it and move forward and hopefully understand that righty-righty matchups aren't as important as looking at the lineup and turning it over to a lesser hitter.
So where is that line then in terms of Okay, so if this is Rojas's weakness, because we know he has a lot of strengths, if his weakness is late game matchups, when does the accountability need to happen? And does it need to be public? So does Rojas need to, after a game like last night, right after the game in front of the media, say that was the wrong decision? Or, Jerry, does he just need to slowly over time develop that skill and realize that he was wrong?
I think a little bit of both. I think understanding that you made a mistake, whether looking back on it in retrospect, not right after a game, maybe he didn't understand it or didn't see it the same way. He'll go back and watch it, and you learn from things. That's the only way you get better. I get better doing this podcast with you because we do it more often. We get reps in. We learn how to flow back and forth. You learn your job. The more experience you have, the better you're going to be. So there's experience coming his way too. I don't need him to own up to it in the moment because maybe he doesn't see it as a mistake in the moment. I think once he goes back and looks at it, he'll own up to it. And he's been quick to come and say, you know, that was on me. I did this, you know, that wasn't a good decision or whatnot. I think he's been honest and forthcoming with how he's felt like he's been doing. And he'll look back on it in retrospect and be able to break down his performance, because that's how managers have to look at what they do too. And he's going to get better from it, you know? And if he doesn't, then he doesn't.
I would say, I agree that he's been honest about his thought process. I think that he could go a step further and say, you know, I made the wrong decision. He'll tell you why he made a decision, which, okay, fair. And that's the most important thing at the time. But once it doesn't work, fans want to know, they want their pound of flesh. And I think that there's just an awareness there that you have to have. You're listening to the Shannon Podcast brought by Verizon, 5G built right for the Mets from the network. More people rely on only on Verizon. All right. Three things left, Jerry. First, Mets fans need to pick me up. Give us a little baseball story.
So a pick-me-up story, I love it. So again, I'll flash back to the Jeter Hall of Fame speech, and he mentioned the COVID delay and him not getting to see some of the Hall of Famers that passed in those 20 months. And he mentioned Hank Aaron. And in 2016, the last year of Turner Field in Atlanta, the bullpen is in left field, and they would peel back numbers on the left field wall, and so you'd get fans or former players to come by. It was a game in June when it was like 44 games left, and Mr. Hank Aaron comes out, walks down the tunnel right in front of our bullpen, and he pulls the number off the wall, and I got a chance to meet him. And it was one of those moments where you meet baseball royalty. I've met a lot of great players. I've played with a lot of guys that demand attention. But he came into the bullpen. He chopped it up with us during the game when it was in between innings. And he was the classiest human being I've ever met in my life. I was literally in awe of this. It really felt like I was meeting royalty, almost like a president. And he was so humble and so forthcoming with knowledge and advice and saying, you know, how proud he was of us to make it this far, asking us about our families. It was one of the highlights of my career to be able to meet a man of his stature and for him to be as humble, as honest and open to just a bunch of fanboys down in the bullpen, and to tell us like he admired us. He's excited about the shape of the game today. He thanked us for being good bastions for baseball. He was proud of who we were. He said, don't beat up on my Braves too badly. And he shook all of our hands and made his way out. And it was one of those moments. If you ask Ricky Bones about it, he was there with me. Addison Reed, Familia was in there. It was one of those moments where, like, you just realize that not only do I get to play baseball and be a part of, you know, a dream, I get to meet people like this. And it was a beautiful moment. I'm so grateful. I have it, that picture framed. And that was a pick me up for me. I still feel it, and it makes me smile because you can see that Hank Aaron smile in that picture. And it's so genuine and so true. And it's so like awe-inspiring. And so that's my pick-me-up story for today.
Love that. And, you know, like so many of the Hall of Famers we've lost the past year, I can't believe he's gone. Can't believe Joe Morgan's gone. We've lost too many, as was stated yesterday. And, but it's great that you got to meet him. I'm jealous. I've heard incredible things about the man that he was. Jerry, right before the podcast, I finished Warrior.
You did.
I struggle with sports movies. Not going to lie to you. It's not necessarily like I thought the action in Warrior was incredibly realistic. Like they did a great job with that. I thought the dad storyline was just a little much for me. And there was some cliche in there with his relationship with his son and the fact that they obviously call him Pop. And then, you know, the wife's role is kind of like the rocky, nervous at home. Those were my issues with it, but still, having said that, very much enjoyed it. Very watchable movie. Give us your rain delay recommendations for this week.
I got my notes today. So I wanted to change it up a little bit. So we're getting close to 9/11. Being in New York, being able to live in that wonderful city, I got to experience the city during that time and what it means. I got to see and talk to so many people that work at the stadium, security people that were there, you know, Jay Horowitz talking about his experiences during that time. I have a newfound respect for New Yorkers. And so I wanted to include this a little bit. So the movie I chose for this rain delay recommendation is called The 25th Hour. It is a Spike Lee movie, one of his like forgotten movies. It's a beautiful movie. So David Benioff actually wrote the novel and adapted the screenplay, who would later go on to be the Game of Thrones fame. So he was the creator of Game of Thrones, just an excellent writer. But Ed Norton plays a guy named Montgomery, who is a drug dealer in New York City. And the 25th hour plays on his last day before he submits himself to a 7-year prison sentence for dealing drugs. And it takes place with his girlfriend, played by Rosario Dawson, who does a great job. He's two childhood friends, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's amazing. And he's like a vulnerable teacher. Barry Pepper, who is Roger Maris in 61, is an amazing job. And it's just one of those movies where there's another father-son dynamic played by Brian Cox. It's a wonderful movie, one of Ed Norton's finest performances, where it's really introverted. And then there's a big Spike Lee rant where he's in the bathroom and he's cursing at everybody and ultimately blaming people. And then at the end, he starts yelling at himself and he finally shows some vulnerability. I love Ed Norton in it. Spike Lee's fantastic. Philip Seymour Hoffman's wonderful. But the underlying current is the movie came out in 2002 and the city of New York post 9/11 plays a big role. You see a bunch of landmarks. You see the skyline and the opening credits. His friend Barry Pepper's his apartment is overlooking Ground Zero. And it shows the impact and the tragedy of it, but it also shows the perseverance of New Yorkers, where they feel it and there's a lot of emotion going on in the city, but they never address it. They just push through. They show their tenacity. They show how much perseverance they have. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie. It has one of my favorite quotes in it. It's a toast. And he says, champagne for my real friends and real pain for my sham friends. And that stuck with me like any other line. It's a classic. If you like acting, if you like writing, Spike Lee does an incredible job. It's a very subtle piece, but it's a wonderful movie with the city of New York and 9/11 playing like a background character. And it's I highly recommend it. 25th hour. Go ahead and do your homework, Doug.
Love it. I'm very excited for that one. Never seen it. I've never seen most of Spike Lee's movies actually, but I love that cast. Love Brian Cox. Love Philip Seymour Hoffman. Love Barry Pepper. So that'll be good.
There's even Tony Siragusa, the Hall of Famer from the Baltimore Ravens, plays a gangster in it. He does a good job with an accent, like a Russian accent. But if you're a dog person, which I know you are, Doug, there's a really good character. Montgomery's dog is in there, It's an awesome dog movie too. So he plays a solid character in there.
It's got everything. All right.
We've got everything.
So last thing, Jerry, and back to kind of the Mets and where they are. So we don't know what the future holds with their front office right now. What we know is that Zach Scott's on administrative leave after his alleged DUI. And look, Andy wrote yesterday for SNY.TV about a couple candidates that, you know, the Mets may be able to bring in as, you know, a potential president of baseball ops or whatever their title would be, team president. Depends if Sandy Alderson's there or not there, what have you. But one of the names that Andy throws out there is Billy Beane. And, you know, my mind goes right to Moneyball and the scene with him and John Henry at Fenway Park, and he decides eventually to stay. You know, he's never left Oakland. I know you spent some time in that organization. Do you think he would be a good candidate? Do you think he would ever come here?
I do think he could come. I think he would be a great candidate. I'm not sure where he's at in his life, what he wants to do. I think he has some ownership stake in the A's. So that would be interesting. He'd probably have to sell that off if he wants. I know he's got some things going on in soccer. And he's moving on in his life. So I'm not sure his interest level and how much involvement he wants. I know he has so much respect for Sandy Alderson. And if anybody can lure him away from Oakland, it would be Sandy. So if you can get him, go get him, because he's a brilliant person, a brilliant mind, a wonderful baseball person. It would be really interesting. I have so much respect for him as a human. He treated me with respect. He was the first person, not the first person, but he was one of the first bosses that I had where I knew this guy is in charge of my destiny, who treated me like a human being, talked to me, answered my questions honestly and forthcoming. Even when it was things that I didn't want to hear, he would tell me the truth, and I'll forever respect him for that. So if you can get him away from Oakland, which is a tough gig because they've got a good team over there too. I think it would be a great get no matter who he's coming in for, what role it is. If you can get him to be a part of the Mets, that would be a win for the Mets.
Imagine Billy Beane with Steve Cohen's money and how different, how different his job would be on a day-to-day basis. But you make a great point about Sandy, because, you know, Sandy Alderson, you know, after he left the Mets, he was, I think, a special advisor within the Oakland A's organization. So clearly there's an amount of respect there. And Sandy, I'm sure, loved his time there, but got too good of an offer and an opportunity to come to the Mets. And so that's a good point. Maybe there's a relationship there that could help lure Billy Beane to New York, but certainly a fascinating thing to explore just for the sake of fodder on this here Shanahan podcast.
Speaking that would be a wonderful podcast, get.
Yeah. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. We appreciate it. Another reminder that Shanahan is brought to you by Verizon. It's 5G built right for the Mets from the network more people rely on, only on Verizon. Jerry, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Good speaking with you. And we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Doug, thanks for showing off your hair today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
It's a good head of hair, buddy. You need to share that with the world.